Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And today, we're going to open the baseball season by going back into the 19th century to the works of Ernest Thayer. It all started in 1885 when George Hearst decided to run for state senator in California. To self-promote his brand of politics, Hearst purchased the San Francisco Examiner. At the completion of the election, Hearst gave the newspaper to his son, William Randolph Hearst. William, who had experience editing the Harvard Lampoon while he was at Harvard College, took to California three Lampoon staff members. One of these three was Ernest L. Thayer, who signed his humorous Lampoon articles with the pen name Phil, P-H-I-N. And in the June 3rd, 1888 issue of The Examiner, Phil appeared as the author of the poem that we all know as Casey at the Bat. And so we're welcoming the baseball season of 2019 with this classic poem. The poem received very little attention, and a few weeks later, it was partially republished in the New York Sun, though the author was now known as Anon. A New Yorker named Archibald Gunter clipped out the poem, and he saved it as a reference item for a future novel that he had in mind. Weeks later, Gunter found another interesting article describing an upcoming performance at the Wallach Theater, a performance by comedian DeWolf Hopper, who was also his personal friend. The August 1888 show had members from the New York and Chicago ball clubs in the audience, and the clipping now had a clear and obvious use. Gunter shared Casey at the Bat with Hopper, and the performance was nothing short of legendary. And here we have Casey at the Bat. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2, with but one inning more to play. And then, when Cooney died at first, and Barrows did the same, a sickly silence fell upon the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought, if only Casey could get but a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake. And the former was a Lulu, and the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all. And Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second and Flynn hugging third. Then from 5,000 throats and more there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley. It rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain and recoiled upon the flat. for Casey, Mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when, responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat, no stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then, while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye, and a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "'Tain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the ump said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone in the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two." "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands. An echo answered fraud. But one scornful look from Casey and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. And they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. A moment which is captured and retained by baseball fans from then till now. Abner Doubleday did not invent baseball. The myth was that baseball was invented by Andrew Doubleday, and we're going to try and show you now that it is a myth and untrue. This myth has been widely spread since 1907, and even today is sometimes presented by such people as Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig. He was commissioner until just a few years ago. The fact of the matter is, there's no record of Civil War General Abner Doubleday having anything to do with baseball. This includes Doubleday himself, who never mentioned it in the many letters and journals that he wrote during his lifetime. Somewhat humorously, the only real reference to Doubleday concerning sports appeared in his obituary in 1893, which stated that he was a man who did not care for outdoor sports. Well, so what happened in 1907 to make people start thinking that Abner Doubleday invented baseball? In 1905, Albert Spaulding put together a panel called the Mills Commission to investigate the origin of baseball. This was in response to an ongoing argument that he had been having with Henry Chadwick about the origin of baseball. And so we pause for just a moment to identify Henry Chadwick and his contributions to baseball. Henry Chadwick authored baseball's first rule book. He devised the batting average and the earned run average, and he compiled the game's first instructional guides and player and statistical reference books, among a variety of other contributions to the game. So he and Abner Doubleday were arguing about the origin of baseball, and Chadwick claimed, correctly, that baseball evolved from a variety of stickball games from Europe, primarily the game of rounders. Chadwick had played as a boy in England. Spaulding claimed that baseball was invented free of such influences and was a wholly American sport. Well, the commission that Spaulding put together did not do very much in the way of hard research on this topic. And by all accounts, it came up with very little. It seemed to rely simply on placing advertisements, requesting that if anyone knew anything about the origin of baseball, they should respond. And finally, in July of 1907, Spaulding sent a letter to the commissioner outlining an account of the origin of baseball that he'd learned from 71-year-old Abner Graves, who was a mining engineer, who incidentally, shortly after giving the account about the origin of baseball, would end up in an insane asylum, where he spent the rest of his life. According to Spaulding, who embellished Graves' statement, on a fateful day in 1839, the man who would later become a Civil War hero supposedly interrupted a game of marbles and taught a group of boys to play a sport he'd just invented. Based solely on this story and without bothering to check its accuracy, the Mills Commission decided that baseball had been invented by General Abner Doubleday in Cooperstown, New York, in 1839. But this was not the end. He then recounted the rules the Doubleday supposedly laid down, which were actually more or less just rules for a version of town ball. Now, town ball was a game commonly played by schoolboys throughout the U.S., and with the exact rules based on where you played it. It, in turn, evolved from the English game of rounders. Spaulding and the commission embellished Graves' story to make it sound more definitive. Now, it is possible Abner Doubleday really did play a game of town ball in the late 1830s in Cooperstown. As this was a common game, and there would have been nothing unique about a young man playing a version of it, but he certainly didn't do it in 1839. Abner Doubleday wasn't in Cooperstown in 1839. He was at West Point at the time, which was 150 miles away. And West Point has no records of him taking leave, including him remaining at the school throughout that summer. Now, given Abner Graves was 4 years old when Doubleday left Cooperstown for West Point, it's not clear how he learned of the details of this supposed first game. Well, as Chadwick thought, the truth of the matter is that baseball wasn't invented at any particular time, nor by any particular group. It was more of an evolution of a variety of games, played with a ball and a stick, something that humans have apparently been doing since there were sticks and rocks. Recent manifestations of these stickball games that predate baseball include one such game played in 1796 in England, and it was called English baseball, that was played with two teams where the batter had three attempts to hit the ball while at a home plate. Each side was given one out. Another popular game in England, mentioned by Chadwick, was known as rounders, which is typically attributed to being a more direct ancestor of baseball. And in rounders, the rules were slightly different depending on where you played, but basically it was a stick and a ball game played on a diamond with bases. The batter would attempt to hit the ball into play and run to a base before being tagged out, which included being hit by the baseball if someone threw it at you. And for a time, that was called soaking. If you got soaked, then you were out on the bases. This gave rise to town ball in the United States, of which there were many varieties. Furthermore, Congress officially declared in 1953 that Alexander Cartwright invented baseball. This is going a little far, as there was nothing truly original about the game that Cartwright and his New York Knickerbockers came up with. It was merely a very slight adaptation on existing games. Furthermore, Cartwright didn't come up with the 20 rules himself. This was a group effort by the New York Knickerbockers. Unlike the height of the pitching mound, the basic layout of the baseball diamond has seen few changes since it originally was accepted as a design in the 1840s. The distance between the bases had remained constant at 90 feet, which continually proves to be the ideal distance without giving favor to either the batter or the runner or the throwing speed of an infielder's arm. It's a perfect logical distance. And with that, we have the myth of Abner Doubleday inventing baseball put to rest, I should hope. And now, why can't cats be called? If your cat ignores you when you call its name, it's not because it doesn't recognize it. It's just because it doesn't feel like responding. That's the conclusion of a new study into the feline mind. The research involved 78 cats who were each played recordings of people reading out four random nouns and then the kitty's name. The scientists found the feline subjects generally responded to their name by pricking up their ears or moving their heads, but unlike dogs, didn't show any major signs of excitement, such as moving their tails or jumping off the couch. Cats may not understand they're being personally addressed. They simply associate the sound of their name with a reward, such as a piece of food, or maybe playtime is going to be happening for them. And while dogs want to please their owners, an expert in animal cognition says cats are not really motivated. They're much better at manipulating our behavior than vice versa. Also from The Week magazine, April 26th, I found this item, which we should certainly take notice of. A drug-resistant gem goes global. A deadly drug-resistant fungus is quietly spreading through the hospitals around the world. Candida auris, which infects people with weakened immune systems, has wreaked havoc in hospital units in Spain and Britain. It's taken root in India, Pakistan, and South Africa, and been added to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's list of urgent threats. There have been at least 587 cases in the U.S. since 2013. Nearly half of the patients who contract C. auris die within 90 days. While public health officials have long warned that excessive use of antibiotics is creating drug-resistant superbugs, the spread of C. auris shows that there's a similar problem with fungi. An estimated 700,000 people worldwide die from drug-resistant infections each year. Yet because the hospitals are reluctant to disclose outbreaks for fear of being seen as infection hubs, the extent of the problem is not fully clear. Scientists can't even establish where CRS originated. It's a creature from the Black Lagoon. According to the New York Times, it bubbled up, and now it's everywhere. And that's going to bring us to the end of today's program. Please take care. Come back next time. Enjoy having you with me. Goodbye.